time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Many aftershocks continue rattling New Zealand after a powerful 7.8 magnitude earthquake jolted South Island early Monday, killing at least two people. Tanya Allardyce is a local grocery store manager.
I was lying in bed and, yeah, everything started shaking and then it got worse and it just didn't stop. I don't like earthquakes at the best of times. So, yeah, it was quite frightening.
The quake struck a remote, sparsely populated region north of Christchurch, causing landslides, rupturing roads, a small tsunami, and damage to buildings more than 200 kilometers away in the capital, Wellington. A dam was breached on the Clarence River north of Kaikoura, prompting officials to urge residents to seek higher ground. Prime Minister John Key is set to visit the area later Monday.
In terms of the areas that are most affected, that's clearly on the east coast around that sort of Kaikoura area and inland around Colvedon and the likes. We've had very limited communications there because that's been cut off, so we've been working through police comms during the night. In terms of getting a better assessment of what happens next, we have military helicopters that are available to us.
A 6.3 quake in Christchurch in 2011 killed 185 and caused widespread damage. Meanwhile, a 6.2 magnitude quake struck northwestern Argentina Sunday. Muslim leaders in Mauritania Sunday urged authorities to execute a blogger who has been sentenced to death for apostasy for challenging decisions by Islam's prophet Muhammad. Sheikh Ould Mekater has been in custody for nearly 3 years. If carried out, his execution will be the first in the country since 1987. Mauritania is an Islamic republic in northwest Africa, tolerating slavery and female genital mutilation. This is VOA News. President Obama embarks on his final official visit overseas Monday with stops in Greece and Germany. Some analysts say he'll seek to reassure European leaders in the wake of Donald Trump's presidential election victory. Meanwhile, European Union foreign ministers met Sunday in Brussels to discuss the possible impact of a Trump presidency on transatlantic relations. EU foreign policy chief Federica Mogherini indicated Sunday the EU must spend more on defense.
I see the needs for Europeans to strengthen their security and defense agenda and cooperation, regardless of changes in the administration in the United States. It is indeed very timely that we discuss these decisions and take these decisions already tomorrow. But again, this would have been true with any kind of administration, I believe. It could be. We'll see what kind of determinations the next administration will take on defense, but it could be more relevant in the future. In any case, this is something it's in our interest to do.
The EU leaders also reaffirmed their commitment to climate change accords and the Iran nuclear deal. An Israeli ministerial committee has voted to legalize an unauthorized Jewish settlement in the West Bank built on private Palestinian land. The vote comes as the Israeli Supreme Court ordered the evacuation of all residents from the Amona settlement near Ramallah and its demolition by December 25th. The Iraqi military says it captured the city of Nimrud near the site of an ancient Assyrian city from Islamic State militants. It's located south of Mosul, where a month-long joint Iraqi-Kurdish effort to recapture that city continues. Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif Sunday opened a new international trade route linking southwestern Gwadar port to the Chinese city of Kashgar, part of a multi-billion dollar joint economic project.
Pakistan is located at the intersection of three engines of growth in Asia, South Asia, China, and Central Asia. CPEC will help in integrating these regions into an economic zone, offering great opportunities for people of the region as well as investors from all over the world.
The first Chinese flag vessel arrived at the Pakistani port with the first consignment of China's so-called One Belt, One Road initiative, linking Xinjiang region with the Arabian Sea. In Moldova, a pro-Russian candidate for president has won the second round of a contest that could determine the country's future ties with the European Union. Igor Dodon apparently upsetting his pro-Europe rival Maya Sandu with about 54% of the vote. China has announced a mixed bag of economic news, fixed asset income rising 8.3% in the first 10 months of the year, while industrial output and retail sales both weakened. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, November 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A Gambian opposition party explains why its candidate will win the country's December 1st presidential election.
We want to bring Gambia back, make sure that everything is in order, the economy back to its feet without anybody being the monopoly of controlling everything. Taking power back to the people.
Youssoufa Jaite is the deputy leader of the opposition Gambia Democratic Congress Party. Zambia's main opposition criticizes an economic plan put forward by the finance minister. South Sudan's security services closed down a U.S.-funded radio station, and a former Lesotho member of parliament calls for a new and stronger coalition government.
That means actually we may see the new coalition being formed, which at this time will include us as the main opposition party in parliament.
Samoyane Unsekele is the secretary general of the All Basotho Convention Party, Lesotho's main opposition party. Smartphones are screening women for cervical cancer in Tanzania. And is your smartphone keeping you from sleeping at night? Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley with a roundup of African sports. And our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In the Gambia, the deputy leader of the opposition Gambia Democratic Congress, GDC party, says its candidate, Mamama Kande, will win the country's December 1st presidential election because he wants to give power back to the people. President Yahya Jammeh is running for re-election and is being challenged by a candidate representing a coalition of seven opposition parties. Youssoufa Jaite, deputy leader of the GDC, denies that his party's candidate, who used to be a member of parliament from the ruling APRC, is running as a stooge of President Yahya Jammeh.
For peaceful takeover and reconciliation, and also to bring back Gambia to its feet where people used to call it the Smiling Coast. We want to bring Gambia back, make sure that everything is in order, the economy back to its feet without anybody being the monopoly of controlling everything, taking power back to the people. That's the reason why we're opting up for that position.
What are your chances of winning the election, given that President Yahya Jammeh has jailed some leading opposition people, including Usainu Dabo? What are your chances?
Well, actually, our chance, like my leader said, the day we were doing our nomination, we're 90% optimistic and 90% prepared to win this coming elections.
Your candidate is a former member of the ruling APRC National Assembly. What do you say to people who say, for example, he is probably being used by President Jammeh to present some kind of semblance that there is a multi-party election?
You know, it's a tradition. It's a tradition in Gambia that a specific opposition party, if you're not part of their clan, they brand you as being part of Yahya Jammeh. It's not new, but it is sad and so disheartening because we are all opposition and we all have a common goal. And where on earth will a presidential candidate who doesn't want to be succeeded, where in the history of politics, you've never seen any dictator use any other political party to succeed him? I mean, I think what they should be focusing on, Yahya Jammeh, the reason why they've been failing all these years is because they've always been branding each other, labeling each other, carving on each other, and this is not politics.
Mr. Jaite, why did the opposition not come together to have a coalition against President Yahya Jammeh? Why?
No, actually, they've got a coalition now. I think eight of them have already made a coalition. It's only my party that did not join, and it was due to the process that was used. And I saw fraud in the whole process, and I cried foul.
What was that?
They had said each party was going to handpick their delegates. And handpicking their delegates, they were supposed to be like six political parties. And then there are three extra parties that did not have any presidential candidate. And those three parties, I said, it's not going to be fair to those parties, and it will not be fair to the parties that are bringing up presidential candidates. Because if those parties are convinced by an individual, they will all go and opt for that individual.
President Yahya Jammeh's government has been criticized by the international community for his human rights record. What do you say to that?
No, actually, that's the reason why I'm into politics now. I mean, I think he's done his bit. He's his quota as a Gambian, and now I'm feeling the pinch on some of the frustrations. And I know the only major problem of him is he is intolerant as a leader, and intolerance is causing a lot of trouble for African leaders. And to be quite honest, I wish they can be very tolerant towards the people. It will make it better. But intolerance is causing all this, and also accumulating absolute power.
Yusuf Jaite is the deputy leader of the opposition Gambia Democratic Congress Party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Banjul. In Zambia, a spokesman for the main opposition United Party for National Development, the UPND, says the budget announced last week by Finance Minister Felix Mutati will have a negative impact on the poorest of the poor in Zambia. The country's economy has been affected by low copper prices and power crisis. In his speech last Friday, Minister Mutati admitted that turning the economy around would require making some hard choices. UPND spokesman Charles Kakoma says the budget announced by the finance minister is in response to what the International Monetary Fund has requested the Zambian government to do if the fund is to issue any bailout loan to the country.
Well, it was anticipated that you would take the route that he has taken, the route of preventing an austerity budget. So it is going to have a negative effect on the poorest of the poor in Zambia. Although he's calling it an economic recovery budget, we believe that there is nothing that is going to be achieved in March, because even looking at his projections, GDP is projected to grow at 3.4% next year in the budget, down from 7%. And with that decline, there's no hope for the job creation that he's talking about. Overall, we think that that budget is basically in response to what the International Monetary Fund has proposed should be done if we are going to bail out Zambia with a $1.2 billion loan.
Well, as the president said, turning the economy around will not be easy. It will require making some hard choices. And besides, he said, you cannot spend money that you do not have.
That is exactly what we did. In fact, in the past, we called it a national cash budget, meaning that without cash, you can't spend. But we are looking at a situation where, as we were introducing austerity in that regard, but the government is increasing expenditure recklessly by creating new departments, creating new ministries, and so on and so forth. So they are not serious about financial discipline. The extravagance will continue, but what is actually going to restrict growth further is proposed the increase in electricity tariffs by more than 300%, the removal of fuel subsidies, and because of those two issues to do with the energy sector, a lot of the manufacturing companies, had already switched to fuel generators because of the electricity load shedding. And now that subsidies have been removed on fuel, that is going to increase the cost of production. Add to that a 300% increase in electricity. How do you produce goods at those astronomical tariffs? So basically, we are going to see a situation where most of the companies are going to shed off employees because the cost would have gone up.
It seems to me the finance minister is banking on the fact that copper output is going to rise. And if that continues, they hope this will help to finance the economy.
Well, we've had this copper problem for decades now. It has never helped the Zambian economy. What should have been done is to diversify the economy away from copper so that we will not depend on copper for all our activities. It's basically financing now more than 75% of our export earnings.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for the opposition UPND Party of Zambia. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. Today's Monday, November 14th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. Lesotho's main opposition, or Basotho Convention Party, says it is ready to be a part of any new coalition government. This followed a call Sunday by parliamentary rebel leader Moyane Moleleke for the formation of a broad-based and stronger government of national unity. Moleleke quit the government last week and called on all parties to join him to move Lesotho forward. Samoyane Unsekele is Secretary General of the All Basotho Convention Party, Lesotho's main opposition party. He says his party has already started talks with Moleleke's Democratic Congress Party.
Actually, as members of the executive of DC, which is Democratic Congress, they had a meeting whereby they took a decision that they are pulling out from the prevailing coalition of seven parties, which they are leading. They are withdrawing DC from their coalition, calling for a new coalition. This is brought upon by the infighting which is prevailing within the leading party in parliament, which is DC, whereby an executive has differed with the leader, who is the prime minister, and took a decision that they are pulling out from their coalition. That means, actually, we may see the new coalition being formed, which at this time will include us as the main opposition party in parliament. Because we are saying this because this is a split of one party, which is DC. It has been divided into two, and the other part has started negotiations with the main party, which is ABC, and it has called for other parties who are in parliament to join them.
So will your party, the ABC, will your party be willing to join this call for a new coalition?
Actually, this deputy leader of Democratic Congress has since started talking with my leader, who is Dr. Motsoahai Tabane. There are some talks which have started already.
You mentioned there's been some disagreement within the Democratic Congress. What is the cause of the disagreement?
Within DC, what has caused the division is that there is a misunderstanding, maybe of part of DC, against the other partner, which is LCD, which they think is the one which is now leading the government, while they know DC is the one which is supposed to be leading the government. This has prompted a decision for this part of DC, which is being led by the deputy leader, to actually take a decision if part of the executive. Actually, there's a division within the executive whereby part of the executive, which is a minority, is being left with the prime minister, while the majority of the executive committee of DC is going with the deputy. Hence why they have decided to pull out from the coalition, because they have a majority.
Samoyele Unsekele is Secretary General of the All Basotho Convention Party, Lesotho's main opposition party. South Sudan National Security Service operators on Friday closed down the U.S.-funded Juba-based iRadio. The radio station's manager says security officers told them to stop broadcast until further notice without explanation as to why they were being shut down. Stephen Omiri says the closure will deny listeners across the country vital information. Michael Atit reports from Juba.
Stephen Omiri says the main station in Juba and six other repeater stations across the country are now off air.
I got a call in the morning from the national security about the station, and we asked to shut down the station. It was a peaceful shutdown, but we are currently working with the authority to resolve the issue so that we can get back on air.
Omiri appealed to the station's listeners across South Sudan not to lose hope.
All the stations, our station in repeated station, are also shut down at the state capital. So that means there's an information vacuum and there's a gap for information. But we are very optimistic that we'll resolve it with authority, because we have been working with them very closely and they seem to be understanding.
iRadio is the second media outlet to be shut down by the National Security Service in the past 2 months. In mid-September, National Security Service officials closed down the Juba-based The Nation Mirror newspaper, apparently for publishing an opinion article about the Central Report, which accused South Sudanese leaders of corruption. Association for Media Development in South Sudan, or AMDIS Chairman Alfred Taban, calls the closure of iRadio unacceptable.
We condemn this kind of doing things, because if somebody is not happy with a radio station or a media house, you should go straight to the media authority and complain to it. It is the media authority to take any measures if it wants to, but not to go and just close down a radio station just like that.
Taban says AMDIS will talk to the national security officials on Monday to make them understand that it is not their place to shut down the media outlets.
We have been trying to bring it to the attention of the security and the authorities in the government that the work of closing down or disciplining radio stations and newspapers should be handled by the media authority, not by the security. But they never listen.
South Sudan's media authority was established in 2013 and was mandated to regulate, develop, and promote independent media outlets in the country. Information Minister Michael Makuei declined to comment on iRadio's shutdown, referring South Sudan in focus to the National Security Service. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
About 500,000 women are diagnosed with cervical cancer around the world each year, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Most cases occur in developing countries where regular gynecological screenings are not widely accessible. But a new smartphone application developed in Tanzania is helping to change that. Sophie Tremblay reports from Moshi.
For these women living on the foothills of Kilimanjaro, the burden of cervical cancer is all too familiar.
One day my aunt started to see a lot of liquid, like she was menstruating. When she went to the doctor, she was told it was cancer. And after that, she stayed at home and she died.
Every year, more than 4,000 women die from cervical cancer in Tanzania, despite the disease being preventable if precancerous lesions are detected in time and removed. Today, Frida and her neighbors have come to be examined for the first time as part of a new screening campaign. The exam involves a smartphone application called Cervical.
When I take the image, I can zoom it and see it in a good view, instead of going direct to the cervix and you can just see on the cervix. But when you take the image, you can zoom in and see if there's any lesion.
Health workers who aren't able to make diagnoses on their own use the app to send the photos to an expert in country who receives a notification. And in just a few minutes, the expert helps the worker on the scene make a diagnosis. The project leader and co-founder of the app's development says they've already trained over 100 health providers and screened thousands of women.
We predict that by the end of the year, we'll probably be up around 7,000 to 8,000.
Because the technology is mobile, she says her team will be able to reach even the remote parts of the country. Leila Umri came to the clinic after one of her friends told her about the experience.
It is important to come here to check my health so that I'm able to live many years and I can take good care of my children.
The team has already received numerous requests to export the technology to other African countries. Sophie Tromley for VOA News in Moshi, Tanzania.
If you have trouble sleeping at night, your smartphone might be to blame. Researchers have found that electronic screen time just before bed appears associated with lower sleep quality. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Researchers have noted for some time that looking at the computer screen, a lighted reading tablet, smartphone, or television set just before turning in for the night may make it difficult for some people to fall asleep. A study published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, for example, found exposure to electronic devices suppresses levels of melatonin, the sleep hormone, making it difficult to fall asleep. In the United States, a National Sleep Foundation survey found 95% of people are looking at their computers or reading a lighted tablet before turning off the lights. A lack of sleep has been tied to diabetes, depression, and obesity. Now comes new evidence in the form of an observation that lighted electronic device exposure at bedtime negatively affects how well a person sleeps. Researchers led by Matthew Christensen out of the University of California, San Francisco, conducted the study.
Even if they're really tired, and you kind of can imagine someone scrolling through whatever news site or Facebook or something on their phone, and that in turn leading to worse sleep in itself.
Christensen and colleagues conducted the first prospective study looking at the effects of smartphone use on sleep quality. The study, published in the journal PLOS ONE, involved 653 individuals across the United States who installed a smartphone application that tracked their screen time exposure. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Here's Samse Omale in Abuja, Nigeria, with a roundup of Africa Sports.
Good morning, James. We begin with the suspension of Bafana Bafana coach Sheikh Mashaba by the South African Football Association, SAFA. SAFA said a coach will not be traveling to Mozambique with the squad to Maputo for an international friendly match against Mozambique on Tuesday, 15th November 2016, for disciplinary reasons. The association did not divulge the details of what they called a regrettable incident in Polokwane at the weekend, where coach Mashaba led Bafana Bafana to beat Senegal 2-1 to go joint top of Group D of the 2018 World Cup qualifiers.
The whole thing that changes the scenario is that we have 4 points. They still, I think that will give us confidence going forward.
In other 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifying games played across the African continent, Victor Moses opened and closed the scoring as the Super Eagles of Nigeria overcame Algeria 3-1 on Saturday to take charge of their group in the 2018 World Cup qualifying. Captain John Obi Mikel, a Chelsea teammate of Moses, was also on target for Nigeria at a packed stadium in Uyo.
So we have to continue like this and playing well like this. I think we have a very good chance of qualifying to the World Cup.
Coach Gernot Rau is the Super Eagles coach.
What I like in this team, we change the team, the same spirit. We had this good spirit already against Tanzania here and in Zambia. So we must conserve it and make better in several situations defensively.
With Cameroon surprisingly held 1-1 at home by Zambia, Nigeria have taken a 4-point lead after match day 2 in Group B, regarded as the toughest of the five African mini leagues. Elsewhere, Morocco coach Hervé Renard had to settle for a 0-0 draw in Marrakesh against Ivory Coast, the third goalless stalemate in four Group C matches. Burkina Faso rocked Cape Verde by scoring twice within 29 minutes of the kickoff in Praia, then survived sustained second-half pressure for a 2-0 victory. Uganda followed up a shock draw in Ghana last month by edging Congo Brazzaville 1-0 in Kampala. Geoffrey Massa is the captain of the Ugandan side.
We played as a team. We managed to create chances. There was a moment I thought we would have made it 2-3, but it didn't come. The important thing was the win. We got a goal and we won the game. That's what we wanted.
Uganda have 4 points in Group E behind Egypt, who have 6 points after defeating Ghana by 2-0 in Alexandria on Sunday. Wahib Kaziri from Egypt Premier League bottom club Sunderland scored to give Tunisia a 1-0 World Cup qualifying victory over Libya in neutral Algiers on Friday. Nigeria's junior female national football team, the Falconets, on Sunday were handed a humiliating 6-0 defeat by Japan in their 2016 FIFA Women's Under-20 World Cup opener in Papua New Guinea. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I'm Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. Over to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. We see you again probably on Thursday. And that's it for this Monday, November 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Bhatia in Washington, hoping that you will have a productive week.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll examine Beyond the Storm, treating the powerless and the powerful in Mobutu's Congo Zaire, a book written by Dr. William Close and Dr. Matudila Malonga, a Congolese physician who co-discovered Ebola in 1976. We'll also discuss the latest developments in the Democratic Republic of Congo on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information. VOAAfrica.com.
news, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
All day, all night.